Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we talk with Jeremy Siegel, host of the new show In Common, which brings stories from across the Commonwealth to the airwaves every Saturday. Then James Sulzer talks to us about his latest mystery set on Nantucket, titled All That Smolders. But first, America's 250th anniversary culminates on June 4th, 2026, marking 250 years since the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. If you recall your history, the battles of Lexington and Concord in April of 1775 were the first major military actions between the British Army and Patriot militias. The Battle of Bunker Hill was another pivotal early conflict in the Revolutionary War. It was in that battle a great patriot lost his life, a patriot who was very prominent in his day, but became less known over the years. Historian Janet Uhler has written a biography of this man, which was first published in 2001 and updated in 2025. She's the author of Liberty's Martyr, the story of Dr. Joseph Warren. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
I'm great. So first of all, how did you become familiar with Joseph Warren? You know, when did he cross your radar?
He crossed my radar in elementary school when I read the book Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes. It was introduced to all the elementary schools in Massachusetts back then, not so much now, but it was pre-Revolution Boston, and it introduced historical characters to the children that most of us in Massachusetts already recognized, but the two that weren't recognized in this book were Joseph Warren and another named Josiah Quincy Jr. And I just kind of was riveted, even at that young age, by their stories and continued. Didn't hear about them again throughout my formal education, but went back to research them when I was homeschooling my kids and they were entering the high school grades. And we were going to do biographical sketches of 13 forgotten heroes and began with Warren. And it was my kids, my oldest one was 16 at the time, and she was so fascinated by his story as we researched it together at that time. She said, "Mom, you need to make him come alive. You need to write a book." And so I did.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, that Paul Revere is so well known, and yet Joseph Warren, not so much. First, tell us a little bit about the relationship between Joseph Warren and Paul Revere.
They were very, very good friends, perhaps best of friends. They had met each other in a Masonic lodge, and that was common practice then for the men to be Freemasons. Revere was about 6 years older than Warren. They became fast friends. Warren became the physician to Revere's family. And then as the pressures of the British oppression, you know, got stronger and stronger, they together joined different patriot groups, one highly secretive patriot group, which was actually the inner circle of the Massachusetts Patriots and the think tank of the pre-revolution. So they were in that group together. The thing that pushed Warren out of the forefront in the telling of the beginning of the American Revolution was Longfellow's poem, which was written, a century later. Longfellow was a descendant of Paul Revere, and he wrote the poem and kind of pushed Paul Revere to the forefront in that story. And Joseph Warren, therefore, fell into the shadows.
He went to the backseat. All right. So he's the one, Warren, who ignited the Revolutionary War. So tell us about that.
He was active in the pre-revolution in Boston from 1768 on to 1775. By 1775, he was the foremost patriot leader, probably throughout the colonies. His name was known throughout the colonies. His name was known in England. He had positioned himself strategically within Freemasonry, not only in Massachusetts, but throughout the colonies. He had risen to the prominent position of most worshipful Grand Master of Freemasons in North America. So it wasn't just Massachusetts. And in gaining that title, and if you study the Masonic records, you can see he was strategically advancing to that position. He would be known throughout the colonies, of course, and he would also have the respect of other Freemasons throughout the colonies, as well as, and I emphasize this, any British soldier or officer who was a Freemason.
Yeah, because it's a brotherhood, right? I mean, that, for people who are not Masons, it's a brotherhood. So, you're like you're saying, he would have this respect that when we see John Hancock and Samuel Adams leaving Boston,
Right.
fearing arrest, Joseph Warren is coming in and out of Boston pretty freely.
Oh, he still lived in Boston. He knew that there was an arrest warrant for him, as well as for John Hancock and Samuel Adams, and that's why they went to Lexington to hide. They were literally hiding from the British general. John Adams, on the other end of it, was off in Braintree. All Patriot leaders by April of 1775. Pretty much all of the inner circle anyway, had left Boston for fear of what was to come, because in April of 1775, Boston already had 4,000 British troops there, and the governor was a military governor, General Thomas Gage. So rumors arrived that 2,000 more military troops were en route to Boston, as well as three more British generals. So therefore, these guys left with their families, got out of Boston. But Joseph Warren, he had sent his children out of Boston. His wife had died. But he himself remained in Boston. He treated his patients just like nothing out of the ordinary was happening. And he was also gathering information and passing it on to Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and others. And therefore, he was in Boston. And interestingly enough, with Paul Revere, who was his lieutenant in Freemasonry, basically. So they could remain untouched. Not only was their respect shown for fellow Masons, but they were protected to a certain degree. They wouldn't be touched. He met with the General Thomas Gage on a regular basis during this period in April, and to discuss how to keep the troops and the townspeople from getting into conflicts. And General Gage, even though he had an arrest warrant for Warren, never touched him. So on the night of April 18th, Warren had gathered information that the British were going to be heading for Lexington and Concord. And he passed that information on, telling Sam Adams and John Hancock to hide because they were going to arrest them in Lexington. They knew where they were, and then go for the munitions in Concord. It had already been set up, the warning signs, if they were headed that way, because Warren didn't know until the last minute on the evening of April 18th. Where exactly the British were going. And even though he made the decision and he was the only one within Boston who could make that fateful decision, because he at the time was president of the illegal, quote unquote, Massachusetts Provincial Congress and chairman of the Committee of Safety. Therefore, from those political capacities, he could order the militia to turn out. So he decided alone to make that decision and called on Paul Revere and Billy Dawes to go and let the countryside know. And then, even though they had fled now, he still remained in Boston. And he did not leave his home until the next morning, when he was informed that shots had been fired on the Lexington Green. Then he gathered up a few belongings, left Boston on a public ferry, so casually, not worried in the least, and was not touched by the British.
Was he a member of the militia?
He, as chairman of the Committee of Safety, would have, he was overseeing the
Overseeing them, yeah.
militia, make that it was the Provincial Congress and the Committee of Safety that formed the Minutemen units within the militia companies.
Right.
He did work, he did go out and drill with militia units at times, was prepared, and in fact, just before the Battle of Bunker Hill, was waiting to be commissioned as a major general.
Yeah. Now, he was an incredibly prominent and accomplished man. Now, here he is, this very well-known doctor, right? So how did he get involved politically? A lot of this, they called on him rather than him stepping forward, right?
Right, for those positions they
Yeah.
did. The only position he sought out personally was that of Major General of the Massachusetts Forces. It went back quite a ways, actually, Mindy. And one of the things I present, talk I present, is why was Massachusetts the focal point of British aggression for 10 years before the war began? And we can't honestly understand the American Revolution without understanding why Massachusetts was the focal point, but yet most books don't even, give any detail to that. It began in Massachusetts as far back as the 1740s when they had land banks trying to, a currency was disappearing in the colony. So they were trying to promote a way to buy and sell using paper currency, but it didn't have the approval of Great Britain. So Great Britain kind of pulled the rug out from under it, and a lot of people lost property because of that. And Joseph Warren's grandfather lost quite a bit of property, as well as Samuel Adams's father. So even that far back, they are kind of realizing that Great Britain is oppressing them. And then you had the whole thing with the French and Indian War. And the people of Massachusetts were self-reliant, more self-reliant than the other colonies, in that they were the first established colony. And they had formed their own government. They had been allowed to do that. They believed in the voting for their representatives and practiced it very well, as well as town meetings and this type of thing. They ruled themselves. So when Great Britain kind of started moving in on them, they felt it very strongly and they opposed it very strongly. And that's part of the reason Massachusetts was the focus. So very early on, he is thinking about all that's coming down by 1768. He's an established physician with a family. He's a property owner. So all this is coming to him and he's responding. And his responses to his patients caught the ear of, and he also belonged to the same meeting house as Samuel Adams and John Hancock Gunn, these guys. And so he drew their attention and was invited to join them in their the inner circle, actually.
Yeah. And unfortunately, he dies in the Battle of Bunker Hill.
He did. He after igniting the war, he went and he was presiding over the Massachusetts Congress and the Committee of Safety, which prepared for battle, prepared the militia companies. And immediately, as the foremost leader here in Massachusetts, he is making decisions and planning for the 16,000 troops that turned out after the battles of Lexington and Concord. These guys came with nothing. He had to, oversee these groups to feed them, to clothe them, to supply them. He had to get up medical, facilities set up for them. Enormous, enormous pressure for the weeks from Lexington and Concord to Bunker Hill. And he was also corresponding with the delegates at the Second Continental Congress, Samuel Adams, and he were very close. In fact, Samuel Adams's son said of their relationship that their hearts beat in unison for their country. So he's writing to Samuel Adams on a regular basis in Philadelphia, telling him what's going on. in one of the letters, he actually is relating to Samuel or telling him, some of our men are getting out of line. They're getting restless because they have no true leadership right now, no commanding general. And he said, you're probably hearing these stories. And he said, I don't want them to be looked down on too harshly because I love these men. I respect these men. And he went on to ask the Continental Congress to appoint a commander in chief to pull that discipline together within these militia units. And he even suggested that George Washington be the one they assigned to that.
Given all of his accomplishments, why do you think he was so forgotten over the years?
I think it was, oh, just going back on your last comment, though, not to finish it up, when he heard that there was going to be another imminent battle, which would end up being the Battle of Bunker Hill. He had not heard from the Continental Congress yet that they had appointed a commander in chief. He knew the men needed solid leadership going into this battle because they were becoming shaky and not having that leadership. And that is when he sought the position of Major General of the Massachusetts Forces. The commission was not. He didn't actually hold the commission at the time of the Battle of Bunker Hill because he was the president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. And in order to be commissioned, they had to put another person in his place as president. So he was awaiting the new president to come forward to commission him. The reason he fell into the background is kind of different things. Again, Longfellow's poem, which kind of just took him out of the whole scene of igniting the war. And he died very young, very early. And others, moved forward and got into that position of being written about, talked about. The first 100 years after his death, there were 14 counties named after him in the United States. He was known, and up until Longfellow's poem again. But also, I was talking to a history professor from Brigham Young University, and he pointed out to me that in the 20th century, the focus of many of the history professors and those who were writing about the history of the American Revolution was on the Continental Congress. And in doing that, putting the focus on the Continental Congress, other people like Warren, another book I wrote was on General Nathanael Greene, who ended the war, basically. And these guys kind of fell into the shadows because they didn't get to the point of being a politician in the Continental Congress.
You updated your book in 2025, and with history, there's often some speculation that goes along with information that one has. As new information becomes available, that narrative can change.
It does change. It can change and does change, and it did with Warren for sure. The biographies written on him, the early ones were 1856 and then in 1964. Then I wrote my book on him in 2001. And there was nothing else out there, specifically on him. Then in 2012, 2013, and 2018, three books came out. Two of them were biographies. One was a book on the Battle of Bunker Hill. And he was the protagonist in that book. And in all three books, the authors took liberty with narrative and not being able to actually substantiate it with documentation. And the narrative in each one kind of presented him, two of them definitely presented him as a 21st century man with the morals of a 21st century man. And you cannot compare a 21st century man to an 18th century man in that respect. You have to respect the time
The time
period. You
period,
have to
yeah.
respect the circumstances and facts of that time period,
And there, but
not that.
yeah, and there were the letters, right? The letters.
The letters, there were letters that came out as well. All three of these authors had put forward or expanded statements made by the two earlier biographers. The first biographer in 1856 stated that Warren was betrothed to a woman named Mercy Scully. That's all he said, that he was betrothed to her for a second wife. But then when you looked for the documentation he based that on, he had not. He didn't cite it at all. He put that in with no citation documentation. So writers after him continued to say that. And again, it was never cited. And they expanded a little bit. The next biography in 18, I'm sorry, 1964 expanded it a little bit. But then when you got into the books in 2012 and 2018, the biographers, they just created this whole story. And the difference was the two earlier biographers did not have access to letters that came to be realized before 2012, written by this woman, Mercy Scully. And even though in reading the letters, this woman never claims to be betrothed to Warren, and in fact is very manipulative and aggressive toward his family. What had happened was Joseph Warren, in April of 1775, had his children staying with his mother in Roxbury at the family farm. When he learned that the 2,000 more troops and three generals were coming to Boston, he decided to send his children to Worcester, which is 50 miles from Boston. Why? We don't exactly know. Perhaps just to get them out of the way of this war that was coming. Perhaps he feared they might be used as leverage by the British if the British took them into custody. From him ordering an attack on Boston. We don't know. All we know is that he did do it. He sent them to the home of a colleague, Dr. Elijah Dix, and with them, he sent a woman named Mercy Scully to be the nanny. And Mercy Scully was a patient of his. She had come to his office many times. Seemingly, he treated her for a nervous disorder type of thing, and he always charged her. Her father was a Boston selectman, John Scully. And John Scully, when realizing the British troops were coming to Boston, made the decision as a selectman to stay in Boston. He was not going to flee. He felt like he needed to be there. And his wife stayed with him. Mercy was a spinster. She was in her early 30s. She was slightly disabled. She talks about having to use a cane. She had never married, never had children, lived with her parents. And perhaps she wanted to get out of Boston, and going to be nanny for these children gave her a purpose and a way to leave Boston. So that's all we know about the relationship between Joseph Warren and Mercy Scully. But then after, as I said, he dies, she has the children, and she's still in Worcester when he dies. And the family does not want to bring the children back too quickly because things are just absolutely crazy in and around Boston at that period. So the children remain with her. We know that 2 months after Warren's death, his mother, Mary Stevens Warren, goes to check on the children in Worcester. and make plans for them to come back to live with her in Roxbury. And at that point in these letters that were just recently realized, Mercy Scully writes that she has gone and made this a public issue by going to John Hancock, Samuel Adams, John Adams, and Warren's minister, Dr. Samuel Cooper, asking them to help her keep custody of the children, even though the grandmother intends to bring them home.
In the end, the family does get the children, right?
In the end, they do, and it seems possible that the re they didn't realize what she was saying in these letters, which we can so easily see now.
Now,
These letters are at historic Cambridge.
Janet Law is the author of Liberty's Martyr, The Story of Dr. Joseph Warren. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Janet, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, Jeremy Siegel joins us. He's the host of the new weekend show, In Common.